academic community. Dean of Students, Ms. Prem Kupo, Senior Lecturer from the School of Translation, Christopher Fotheringham, the Chairperson of the Bhakti Yoga Society, Muzi Nantlawane, a very good evening to you. Welcome to the inaugural Bhaktivedanta Swami Lecture, hosted by the African Division of the Bhaktivedanta Book Trust, which is based in Taiwan, Australia, Los Angeles, Sweden, Rio de Janeiro, Mumbai, and convened here at this prestigious institution of learning, where Bhaktivedanta Swami himself lectured in October 1975. The Bhaktivedanta Book Trust is the world's largest publisher of books in Vedic thought, with translations in over 90 languages, including Chinese, Farsi, and Kiswahili. It seeks to bring an ancient message to the forefront of modern thinking. This is the first of an annual series of lectures intended to stimulate thinking and promote debate on the issues of the day. The first responsibility of any leader is to define what is reality. And so in training future leaders, an education system should empower, stimulate, and challenge us to explore what reality is. For example, when economic growth is pursued with reckless disregard for the environment, it leads to pollution that disfigures the landscape. Our immediate response is due to our affiliation to nature is to find some interventions to balance this out. So as human beings, we are full of capacity and instrumentation for deep introspective thought. And the words of Aristotle, and I quote, "The educated differ from the uneducated as much as the living differ from the dead." Bhaktivedanta Swami was perturbed by seeing this deadly combination of ignorance and disinterest and emphasized the deep value of thoughtful education. And so it is precisely such deep introspective thought that the Bhaktivedanta Swami lecture seeks to invoke. Because to challenge the status quo to achieve the topmost benefit for humanity is the essence of education. Distinguished colleagues, today we have the pleasure of having with us a direct student of Bhaktivedanta Swami, His Holiness Jayadvaita Swami, who will deliver this evening's lecture on Where is Our Education Leading Us? He is an editor, a publisher, teacher, and has been a senior editor for the Bhaktivedanta Book Trust for the last 40 years. He is a strongly independent thinker and a respected scholar from the tradition that Bhaktivedanta Swami himself represented. Jayadvaita Swami is of Jewish descent, hails from the area of New York, where he became a full-time monk in 1968. Some 45 years ago. He travels widely and has taught and lectured in over 50 countries. This lecture is scheduled to last for 30 minutes and will be followed by an open session. Thank you again for your attendance and interest in the subject of education. Now please join me in welcoming His Holiness again to our beautiful country and to this distinguished university of learning, His Holiness Jayadvaita Swami.
Ladies and gentlemen, distinguished guests, since this is the first Bhaktivedanta Swami lecture, let me begin by saying something about the person in whose honor it's been named and how what he taught is relevant to our topic today. His name is a long one, His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Scholars most often refer to him more briefly as Bhaktivedanta Swami or increasingly these days, by the name his followers most often use, Srila Prabhupada. I first met Srila Prabhupada in New York City in 1968. After a difficult journey on a freighter on which he'd received free passage, he'd come from India to America 3 years earlier at the age of 69. He'd long since left behind him business and family affairs. And after years spent in study and writing, now he'd come to America with little more in his possession than a few rupees and some trunkloads of books. The books were the first three volumes of his translation with commentary of a great Sanskrit epic known as Srimad Bhagavatam, a book revered in India but little known in the West, a book of philosophy, of culture, practical knowledge, and above all, of spiritual understanding. Decades earlier, when Srila Prabhupada was in his 20s, his spiritual master had asked him to teach the message of this Bhagavatam and other related writings in English. So that was what Srila Prabhupada was now doing. The earliest of these writings, all in Sanskrit language, are known as the Vedas. And so the tradition of wisdom they represent is known as the tradition of Vedic wisdom. The word Veda, which literally means knowledge, comes from the Sanskrit root vit, to know, which is related to our English words wit and wisdom, but not to its water's rent. It was to teach this Vedic wisdom that Srila Prabhupada, in the last 10 years of his life, came to New York and later traveled 14 times around the world, including twice here to South Africa. It was also why he wrote a veritable library of books with titles now translated into some 90 languages, including French, German, Arabic, Zulu, Xhosa, Tswana, and Swahili. So what was this Vedic wisdom that Srila Prabhupada had come to teach? Why should we care about it? And what does it have to do with education? According to the Vedic tradition, education should aim at enabling us to achieve success in achieving four objectives: religion, economic development, the satisfaction of our needs and wants, and finally, liberation. This is not political liberation, but something far more important. And I'll come back to that later, to what that is. When we speak of the first objective, that of religion, this does not refer to a sectarian dogma or creed. The Sanskrit word here is dharma, and it refers to something broader and deeper. Dharma refers, first of all, to an essential intrinsic quality, what something or someone is meant to do. The dharma of water is to flow. The dharma of chili is to be hot. The dharma of sugar is to be sweet. And the dharma of a living being is to serve. The shopkeeper serves the customer. The worker serves the company. The doctor serves the patient. The teacher serves the students. The citizen serves the nation. And along with that, or on top of that, we all serve our senses. We serve the demands of our tongue, of our eyes, of our ears. They want to taste something, to hear something, and so on. And ultimately, our dharma is to serve God. As a hand is part of the whole body and is therefore meant to serve the whole body, every one of us is a part of God and therefore meant to serve God. Now, we all serve in some particular occupation, and that's another meaning of dharma. According to our natural leanings and skills, some of us serve as teachers, some as military and political leaders, some as farmers and businessmen, some as workers and technicians. The particular service we do is another aspect of our dharma. And while serving, we're meant to follow some basic moral principles: truthfulness, cleanliness, austerity, mercy. And this too is another aspect of dharma. Multifaceted term. Now, by serving in whatever our occupation, we should naturally achieve the second objective: economic development. We should have a roof over our head, clothes on our back, food on the table, money in our pocket. And so we can achieve the third objective. We can satisfy our needs and our desires. Then finally we come again to the fourth objective: liberation. As I mentioned, this is not just political liberation, rather it refers to spiritual liberation, the liberation of the soul from material entanglement. And this is something our modern education wants nothing to do with. Soul, that's something that belongs to religion. What does that have to do with education? But when the Vedic sages speak of the soul, they're not merely talking religion. They're speaking of something fundamental, of the most essential object of inquiry. The Sanskrit word they use is atma, another word rich in meaning. It can also be translated as spirit or simply as oneself. To know our atma is to know who we ultimately are. And how can one be an educated person if one doesn't know who one is or doesn't even ask? To know what I should do with my life, I should first know who I am. And so the ancient Greek aphorism, know thyself. What is this self? For the Vedic view, we can turn to the Bhagavad Gita, the celebrated book of wisdom spoken by Sri Krishna. There, in Sanskrit, Krishna says, nasato vidite bhavo na bhavo vidite sataha upayorapi drishtontas tvanyos tattvadarshibhi. That which lasts is unchanging, and that which changes never lasts. Those who are seers of the truth have ascertained this by studying the ultimate nature of both. Now, my body is always changing. At birth, my body was that of a baby. Then I grew up, and my body was that of a child, then a youth. And now I have the body of an old man. But while I've been changing from body to body, like a person putting on different sets of clothes, I've always been the same person. what lasts throughout all of these changes of body is the fact of my individual consciousness. And so the Vedic sages say, I'm not my body. I'm the spark of consciousness within the body. This way of thinking is not merely theoretical. It has consequences. Social, political, economic, personal. When I identify with this body, I think, I'm white, or I'm colored, or I'm black, or I'm Zulu, or I'm Xhosa, I'm American, I'm South African. But the conscious self within the body is neither white, nor colored, nor black, neither Zulu, nor Xhosa, neither American, nor South African. For that matter, neither man nor woman. And therefore, when I think of myself and others only in terms of the outward body, not considering the inner self, I'm an illusion, an ignorance. And if I'm in ignorance, what does it mean to say that I'm an educated person? Once Srila Prabhupada was invited to speak at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, one of the finest of America's schools of higher learning. And to the students and professors who gathered to hear him, this is what he said. I see that in this institute you have so many departments of knowledge: chemistry, biology, astronomy, physics. But where's that department to study the difference between a living body and a dead body? Within the living body is the force of consciousness. Within the dead body, that consciousness is gone, and no one can bring it back. The living body moves and acts because of consciousness. And therefore, within the body, consciousness is the most essential element. Where is the department to study that? But of course, there was no such department. We study nature, we study the world, but we don't study the conscious force that moves the world. We don't study the self. Instead, we just take it for granted that the self and the body are the same. We misidentify the self with the body. I'm white, I'm black, I'm American, I'm South African. And on top of that illusion, we build up our education, our science, our lives, our societies. And so we focus on that which is changing, and we lose sight of that which lasts. And when I think, in effect, I'm this body, I think of that which is related to the body, or that which I can grab for it, as mine. My land, my slaves or workers, my gold, my diamonds, my colonies, my empires. If something's mine, it's not yours. And so we compete for it, each of us trying to hold on to what we've got and lay our hands on what we don't have. And this leads to conflict, to exploitation and injustice, to hatred and cruelty and brutality, to rioting, to war. Or else, we form partnerships and alliances. Why should this be mine or yours? Let's call it ours and divide it fairly. This is what Srila Prabhupada called thieves dividing honestly. What factually belongs to us? The land was here before we came. It will still be here once we're gone. So too, the people, the gold, the diamonds, the colonies, the empires. How are they ours? And if we claim as our own what's not ours, are we not thieves? And how will thieves divide their stolen property honestly? According to the Ishopanishad, a Vedic text, Ishavasya midam sarvam yatkin cha jagatyam jagat tena chaktena punjita magritta kasya svitthanam. Everything within the universe, whether animate or inanimate, belongs to the person who ultimately controls them. That is, to the Supreme Lord. We should therefore accept only what we need for ourselves, what's set aside as our quota. And we should not grasp for other things, knowing well to whom they belong. Now, when I own and control something, I say it's mine. My wallet, my cell phone, my dog, my car, my home. But whatever I call mine is factually only on loan. It's mine for a while, not more. Even my body, which I certainly say is mine only for some time. And even then, I can't fully control it. I can't stop it from getting old, nor from dying. So finally, the grave or the funeral pyre takes it and says, it's mine. Yet here I am, thinking I'm this body, and claiming that whatever I can hold on to is mine. And because I can show a diploma, I'm an educated person. The architects of apartheid were certainly educated persons. And so too those who enforced it. But not from the Vedic point of view, because they were acting in the bodily concept of life. And that means ignorance. A Vedic verse says, those who follow a life of ignorance go downward into darkness. And still further into darkness go those engaged in the cultivation of knowledge. In other words, having wrong-headed knowledge, wrong-headed education, is worse than having no education at all. That's not to say that one shouldn't be educated, but education should make a person finer, not more foolish or more vicious. The person who's factually in knowledge, Krishna tells us, sees every human being, in fact, all beings that live, with an equal eye. When we see that the body is but an outward covering of the self, and we see that the true self is the spark of consciousness within, then we can see with that true equality of vision. And this is the vision of a truly educated person. such a person can factually attain liberation in the spiritual sense of the term. Liberation from the illusions of material existence. This doesn't require that one give up one's family or give up one's work. Rather, it calls for a change in understanding, a change in vision. From material, I'm this body, to spiritual. I'm the lasting spark of consciousness within this body, and all living beings have the same spiritual nature. Welcome. When the Vedic wisdom speaks of all living beings, it offers a vision in which goodwill and fellowship are to be extended not only to all other people, white, black, or whatever, but even to the animals, to the birds, to the trees, to the fish, to all beings that live. They too have consciousness. They too have life. In the Bhagavad Gita, Sri Krishna says that the learned person, the truly educated person, sees with equal vision the teacher, the cow, the elephant, the dog, and even the person who eats dog meat. Outwardly, these are all certainly different, but he sees within them all the same spiritual spark of consciousness. And so, Krishna says, by seeing that all other living beings are the same in essence as oneself, the learned person sees the true oneness of all living beings, both in their happiness and in their distress. Such a person is truly connected with God. I want to be happy, so do all other living beings. And just as I feel pain, so do all others. Why then should I not want all others to be happy? And why should I cause any other living being needless pain? And so, the Vedic aphorism, Sarve Sukhino Bhavantu, may there be happiness for all. In practical terms, this implies a change of diet. From a diet that relies on cruelty and slaughter to a diet gentle and humane. To inflict pain and suffering on millions of animals through wholesale slaughter, and then to expect friendship and peace and tranquility among human beings is to live in a fool's dream. According to the Vedic wisdom, one result will come to us when we follow a life of ignorance, that is, of supposed knowledge that fails to go beyond the bodily concept of life. And a very different result when we cultivate a life of true knowledge, a knowledge that begins with an understanding of our own spiritual nature and the spiritual nature of all living beings. And so the Vedic wisdom says that one should gain both material knowledge and spiritual knowledge side by side. And in this way, one can go beyond material existence, even beyond death, and taste what the Vedic sages call the nectar of immortality. For the body, there's no question of immortality. And for the conscious self within the body, there's no possibility of death. That is what the Vedic sages have seen. By carefully considering the ultimate nature of both, both matter and spirit, both the body and the conscious self. In the Vedic view, since the conscious self is immortal, after the death of the body, it continues to exist. As we change bodies from that of a child to that of a youth to that of a person in old age, so at the time of death, we move on to a new body in another lifetime, in a continuous cycle of birth and death. Now I'm present in this room, and now you can see me. But it's not that I popped into existence only when I walked into the room, nor is it that when I leave the room and you no longer see me, I'll cease to exist. Before coming into this room, you know I was present somewhere else, in another room, and when I leave, I'll go somewhere else. And so it is with consciousness, with the self. Now, here we are, in our present bodies, all physically present. But before, we must all have been elsewhere. And when we leave, again, we must go elsewhere. No one can create consciousness, no scientist, no engineer. And no one can destroy it. So what happens to it? According to the Vedic view, it always exists and it travels from one lifetime to the next, being born, living out its life, then dying and moving on again. And so it is that we're born into different circumstances, different families, sometimes rich, sometimes poor, sometimes healthy, sometimes diseased. Our circumstances in this life result from our actions in the life we had before, and our actions in the present life create the life we will have next. Just as what we do in grade school might make us eligible to attend a certain college, and how we apply ourselves in college makes a difference when we enter the job market. By our present actions, we create our future. And all that we do in the present life is summed up at the time of death. This is a large topic, and time prevents us from pursuing it here in much detail. But it's worthy of our further study, because the ultimate problem of human life is not one of those problems we find in our newspaper headlines. It's the problem each of us must face. Each of us must deal with, to which all the sages direct our attention, the problem of death, and what, in the face of it, each of us should do. Earlier in this talk, I mentioned that according to the Vedic tradition, education should aim at enabling us to achieve success in four objectives: religion, dharma, economic development, satisfying our needs and wants, and finally, liberation. In the Vedic view, the ultimate goal is liberation, and the other three objectives are stepping stones along the way. Through dharma, leading a moral life while working in a suitable occupation, we earn what we require to satisfy our needs and wants, so that we can pursue and understanding of our ultimate purpose in life, and taste, as the Vedic sages say, that nectar of immortality. That is the ideal of Vedic education. Vedic education endeavors not to stuff a child with knowledge, but above all, to build character, to instill the values of cleanliness, truthfulness, austerity, mercy. It promotes economic development, especially through a simpler way of life, in which we make proper use of nature's gifts and live in harmony with nature. In this way, it enables us to meet our needs, and it teaches us the art of being satisfied with what nature gives us, and not trying to scheme and exploit and bully our way into trying to get more at the expense of the lives and happiness of others. And it keeps always in view that our present life is temporary and that its true purpose lies in spiritual realization. But education as we know it today, quite a different story. Morality and personal character are of little concern. Liberation is out of the picture. The focus is squarely on economic development, making money. And for this, our education trains leaders to build an over-industrialized world where millions of people can toil in mines and factories so that a few can live in luxury, with the middle class in between to serve as emerging target markets and consumer units. With such an education, we focus on meeting our needs and wants, and not only meeting them, but expanding them, in the expectation that the more we get, the happier we'll be. This expectation is false, and therefore, the education we receive is a false education, leading us to work like donkeys, with the carrot of happiness always dangling before our face at every step, sure to be ours if we only can just catch up with it. Our poster for this evening's program mentioned that the World Economic Forum ranked South Africa's educational system as one of the world's worst. Of 144 countries, number 140. And a year ago, Mamphele Ramphele said, famously, that South Africa's educational system now is worse than the gutter education the country had under the apartheid government. But suppose that by some miracle of good government and educational reform, now we're really talking miracles. Suppose that Africa's educational system were to move up from the bottom of the list and join the ranks, if not of Switzerland and Finland and Singapore, numbers 1, 2, and 3, but then at least of the United Kingdom and the United States, numbers 27 and 28. Srila Prabhupada would say that this miraculously transformed educational system would still be a grand failure. Why? Because it would still be built on ignorance, on mistaking the body for the self, and on making the gratification of our bodily demands, the needs for eating and sleeping and mating and defense, the central focus of our life. The animals know of no higher purposes in life than to eat, to sleep, to defend themselves against attack, and to have sex. And of course, as human beings, we share these same needs. But human life is meant for a higher purpose. We may eat more nicely than animals in a restaurant or a hotel. We may sleep in a more comfortable bed. We may defend ourselves with guns and missiles instead of claws and teeth. And we may have sex with the aid of condoms and pills. And that may make us better animals, more polished animals, more sophisticated animals, but it doesn't make us more than animals. And human beings living as no more than animals will never be truly successful, nor even happy, to say nothing of achieving the ultimate goal of life. For that, we need a truly higher education, one that begins in childhood and extends throughout one's life, an education that enables us to understand, first of all, the difference between the temporary body and the permanently existing conscious self. We need an education that enables us to see that whatever exists in this world is not our property to be fought over or cleverly divided and exploited, but the property of God, the ultimate controller and owner of everything. We need an education that teaches us how to work in harmony with nature, not against it, by living a simpler life, meeting our basic needs by depending on nature's gifts. And we need an education that enables us to keep in view the ultimate purpose of human life, to rise above what's illusory to what's real, from darkness to light, from death to immortality. It was to promote this sort of education that Srila Prabhupada journeyed on that freighter to New York, that he came here twice to South Africa, and that he wrote so many books. The knowledge found in these books is like gold, and I dare say that it's more valuable than all the gold ever found in South Africa. And for this gold, no mines, no exploited workers, no ruinous environmental impact, no international competition. It's pure, and it's beneficial, and it's yours for the taking. This doesn't involve switching from one religion to another. Whatever our religion, whatever our culture, whatever our race, whatever our nationality, we can take advantage of this knowledge and benefit. Its value is universal, crossing all lines. Gold is gold, regardless of where it comes from. There's no question of Russian gold or South African gold, Hindu gold or Christian gold or Muslim gold. Wherever we find gold and whoever we get it from, it has value. So too with knowledge. The Bhagavad Gita says, there's nothing so sublime and pure as transcendental knowledge. Such knowledge, the Gita says, is the king of education. And I invite you to give your open-minded consideration to this knowledge with the utmost seriousness. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We'd like to give another hand of applause to his holiness, please. That lecture had some very provocative statements. We in the audience are very intelligent persons from academia and persons who are committed to higher values around education. And I would like to open the floor for an engagement with His Holiness. Maharaj, if you could just please sit there so they could see you. If you could just state your name when you ask a question and the institution or the affiliation you belong to, so everyone would know where you're from. So I'd like to open the floor for some questions. Yes, sir.
My name is Tiseto, I'm from this university. My question is sort of simple. We were talking about how if we were to suddenly improve our education system and to be at the top of the system as it currently is, it would still be a great failure. I understand you when you say that. What I wanted to ask perhaps is, do you have examples of places that are succeeding in the way they educate their people, their societies, maybe even on a very small scale, something that we can look to as an example of how you would like things, how things should be?
Thank you very much. Good question. Stand here, it's better.
I'd say first I can look back historically, and I can say that the books that I've been speaking about were part of a culture. They weren't just books. And back in that culture, this was the norm, that people were educated to understand this, that the teachers would be people of purity, of deep realization, of practical understanding, that the leaders would be people of enormous responsibility, who felt that the citizens were practically like their children and needed to be protected and cared for the same way, where the farmers were actually the economic basis of society, not the nuts and bolts and petrol, but grains and fruits and vegetables, and where the farmers, instead of being representatives of some multinational demonic corporation, tended the land, cared for the land, cared for the animals, and where the workers helped in all of these other departments and were valued for their contribution. That's a culture which is in the past, we've lost touch with, but that's the culture that we want to bring back. On a small scale, we have schools. One especially comes to mind in Mayapur, in West Bengal, in India, where students are being trained in this way. There's a project in Congo. Not someone that I'm close with, but his mother used to be one of my authors publishing days. He has a project in the Congo dedicated to village life, where there's enormous productivity by caring for the land and actually using animals for traction and work. So there's pieces. And, you know, like seeds, you water them and they can grow.
Thank you. So we didn't get your name or your Are you a student here?
Yes.
Do we have another question for the Swamiji?
Yes, right there.
Please don't forget to state your name and the institution you belong to.
Right back over here, I saw a hand. Am I right? Or are you pointing someplace else? There you are. Okay.
Good evening. My name is and I'm from Wits University. The most provocative statement you made was that excessive scholarship leads to more foolishness. So, if you have higher education, higher qualifications like a doctorate and anything like that. And earlier we saw that the qualifications of the master's ceremonies is that he has a doctorate in business administration. So what I'm essentially asking is, how is it, in the Vedic concept, that you can have a high material education at the same time still be broad-minded and understanding yourself?
Dr. Singh is very suspect here. The idea is that education without self-knowledge is a shell. And that shell, what do they say? A little learning is a dangerous thing. A lot of learning is a more dangerous thing. If we don't know who we are, if we don't know who the world belongs to, if we don't know who others are, then what do? We use our education destructively. We use it on so-called defense, which burns up half the world's tax money. We use it on inventions that exploit and cause more trouble than whatever problems they're meant to solve. We become more proud. I have a degree, I have an advanced degree, I have 5 degrees. But I'm a dog, because I think that to eat, to sleep, to mate, and to defend myself is all there is to human life. So we're fine with education, with degrees, with science, with higher education in every sense, with spiritual knowledge alongside. I quoted earlier that the sages say one should cultivate material knowledge along with spiritual knowledge, both side by side. If you have one and not the other, you have imbalance. If all you know is spirit and you don't know how to grow a potato, you don't know how to eat, you don't know how to support yourself, you're in problems. And if all you know how to do is advance in your career, advance in your family life, advance in temporary values, you're unbalanced the other way. And that's what we have now. We have an unbalanced world with so much emphasis on the temporary, an educational system that's geared the same way. I was reading that Economic Forum report valued education because it produced good workers. Is that what your life is for, to be a good worker? You come out of here and you're eminently employable? That's fine, not against employment, but for what? What is the purpose of my life? To work in a big bank and have a lot of stuff and then die? The same way that the poor man dies, the same way the dog dies. So both things must be there. Don't drop out of Ritz. But we have so much to balance your Ritz education. We have a lot of books. Okay?
Another question?
My name is Vanita and I'm a graduate.
A question is related to the four goals of life that you mentioned earlier. And one could argue that we are an academic institution, therefore we could be fulfilling the two goals of...
Therefore
we could be fulfilling or meeting the objectives of economic development and science communication. And therefore it can be other institutions' objectives to meet the other two of Dharma, liberation, spiritual realization, etc. What would be your response to that?
That this is an institution for academic education, and therefore it's appropriate that it focus on economic development and leave the other things to other institutions.
Yes.
I would say that that's creating a unwholesome fragmentation in our life. And unwholesome, because it's you don't want to separate your the parts of your body and feed one part and say, well, over here sometimes they'll do something for another part. It's meant to be holistic. Education is not meant to be fragmented. Spiritual knowledge is meant... Take any course. Take science, take economics, take physics. If they're not spiritually informed, you have a problem. So science develops ideas that matter is everything, that there's nothing beyond matter, and doesn't take into account the role of consciousness, except as it impacts physical systems. It doesn't ask, what is this consciousness? Where does it come from? And if it does ask, it says, well, it came from little bits of chemicals, which is a bias. It's not that science shows that, has shown that, has produced all of these nice little living beings that grew in laboratories from carbon and hydrogen and oxygen and potassium. But there's a certain worldview, a reductionistic, materialistic worldview, which infects our science. And therefore, Srila Prabhupada at MIT, a great scientific institution, said, where's the department to study consciousness? It should be integrated. Come to economics, the same thing. This Vedic literature is not just theoretical spiritual literature. It speaks to government, it speaks to economic development, it speaks to the kind of issues like spiritual equality that have been terribly missing historically in South African education. And there's a practical example. You have fantastic education, minus deep spiritual understanding. And what does that result in? It shouldn't be left to the side. Well, this is something we'll deal with in our spare time. This is the central focus. The other things are meant to support that. And if there's nothing to support, we make the foundation, the whole building, then we're missing.
You mentioned that South Africa is one of the worst education systems or education. I forgot to tell you, my name is Bruce and I'm also a student here at Wits. You mentioned that South Africa has one of the worst education systems. I think you said number 144 in the worst. In what aspect is...
What was that ranking?
In what aspect is this... Is South African education one of the worst education?
Yeah, okay.
And also, I'd like to know what level of education are you talking about? Are you talking about higher education.
Right.
Or you're talking about high school education going down to grade zero.
Good, good questions. The World Economic Forum's report is online, and they do break it up. They have ranking of primary education, they have ranking of higher education, and so on. And South Africa wasn't at the very bottom of all of them. And I forget the actual numbers. But then there was a table which just said the quality of the educational system, and it didn't make distinctions, didn't specify. And that's where it was 140 out of 144. Now, on what criteria? Very interesting. What mattered to them? How the education contributes to the economic development of the country. That was their standard. And that in itself tells you something. Here are these great world leaders, and that's what they're focused on. And that's fine, we need economic development. But that's so often as far as it goes. Economic development, and you know, how many internet connections and how many cell phones per capita or per 1,000 people or what have you. And it's a thick report. You can read all the charts and see where all the countries stand and lots of different things. Their education, the perceived honesty of their leadership. I don't have a number for South Africa, I'm not saying anything. But lots of different points. But there was no quality that said ultimate value in life doesn't raise the issue. What are we living for? We're living for economic advancement. Maybe, I don't want to short these people, maybe they have some higher thoughts in mind. But that's what their report is about, to answer your question. I hope it does answer your question. Okay. If you wanted to drop an email to me, I could give you the figures for the other, for lower education and higher education. Why don't you speak real close into that microphone and we'll hear you better.
Okay. This is probably an argument to in favor of economic development. But my feeling is that sometimes government policy and the education within which dictates our policies, which dictate our education rather, are geared towards economic development, because especially in South Africa, we realize that without that kind of development, then a lot of people who were previously disadvantaged had less ability to then realize their potential as individuals, and possibly even their spiritual consciousness because of the kind of conditions that they live in.
Yeah, fair enough. The educational system emphasizes economic development because we need it and because it's deficient. Okay. I'm for economic development. We said there were four goals. Economic development is one of them. The first one is Dharma. I'm not against Dharma. I'm not against economic development, nor against satisfaction of our needs and wants. My first question would be whether our scheme of economic development is really going to provide true prosperity. When you have an economic system that's really about industrialization, about workers, and about multinational corporations and their interests and international investments and so on, are we really getting freedom? Are we really getting fulfillment for our people? Or, in the name of solving the problem, are we getting ourselves deeper into problems? I come from a country which doesn't have this kind of background. And, okay, we have a super ultra strong economy, we have iPads coming out of our ears. But I don't see that now people have achieved their full potential and they're walking around the streets with smiles of contentment on their faces. It's like a fish, you know, you take him out of water and offer him a lounge chair and a cigar and opulent meals. He's not going to be happy because he's a fish. So meeting the needs of the outward body, although necessary, doesn't satisfy the needs of the person. That's the first point. If we don't go beyond that, we're missing what life is for. I'm prosperous, I've got a good education, I got a good job, I got a good house, I got a good home, and I died. And what did I live for? You get this tremendous emptiness, even in the most, you know, Finland, Singapore, and what was the third one?
Switzerland.
And I go to those places. It's not that their smiles are wider than in country number 27 and country number 28 or 104. But that's the first thing. And I would argue that real prosperity comes not from industry, from land. You can't eat iPads, tractors, nuts and bolts. The real basis of human prosperity is the land. Grains, vegetables, fruits, milk, cotton, silk, honey, everything that we actually need, nature provides. Timber, stone, it's all there. And we want to turn our back on the countryside, stuff everyone into Johannesburg and New York and Tokyo, and then, well, what are we going to do? Because the crime rate is off the charts, because pollution, and everybody's buying 100 new cars a year, and now we need more highways and more police and more this and more that. And life becomes better. It doesn't. So we would argue for a radical reexamination of what prosperity really is. Is it really skyscrapers and gadgets? In some senses, was South Africa more advanced in its original culture? I would say that in some ways it was. You look at New York City when the Red Indians had it, and look at the place now. It was better before. You can go up to the Hudson River and drink the water. No one dares do that today. In the name of prosperity, we ruin everything.
Forget to say your name.
Yep.
My name is Juan Marcos. I am with UNICEF, the Children of UNICEF. When you walk around the country on a Sunday, you see many people who are in various problems, obviously, in pursuit of spirituality. There is a growing perception in the country that it is because they are unable to get onto the next level, which is that of economic prosperity. Could that be true? I'm saying it's a growing perception that when you can't make it, you rather stay with the spiritual goals. Is it true or not that you fall back on that?
It's true that
to stay with the spiritual, in pursuit of spiritual life, you're not moving on to the economic field.
The the religion is primary. It's the beginning. It's the first thing. It's baseline. You want your people to be moral. You want your people to be truthful. You want your people to be honest. You want your people to be responsible in their lives. That's baseline. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife. These are, you know, baseline things.
Accept that, but I'm saying... I'm saying the problem is that in this country, and I could be generalizing here, you found the majority staying there, and most of them are unable to prosper in the next level, economic development.
Well,
I'm saying it's a growing perception.
Yeah.
What could be the reason for that?
Okay.
Can I have just reframe that question?
Yeah.
First question. Just tell me if I'm wrong, sir. You're saying that you see on a Sunday,
many persons pursuing different types of faith, religion, etc. And you're asking the question, is it perhaps that they've reached the ceiling or they don't have the ability to move to the next level, so they just default to religion?
That's exactly what is happening.
Okay.
Check who's still there. Most of the time they're unable to move to the next level.
Should the Swami get a job?
Should the Swami get a job
and contribute something? Let's look at a couple of things. I think it's good that on Sunday there's spiritual. I've seen also walking the streets that on Sunday so many people are on their way to some religious service, and that's fine. I'm not convinced that that means that people are sort of stuck on platform of religion, that the other 6 days they're absorbed in theology or worship. That's the first thing. I don't think the problem is that we're stuck, that everybody's just so busy in their spiritual life that they don't have time to run around. That's not the problem. Even the problem is that when they go for their spiritual service, sometimes they're told, you know, just put your money in the donation box and your one rand will become 20. Right? And we see that the minister's driving in a, you know, he's got the gold watches and the big car. So in one sense, your spirituality becomes just another business. Economic development for the preacher. So there's a shortage of this deeper understanding. That's what I'm saying. It's not a question of religion. It's not a question of whether you go to the Catholic Church or the Baptist Church or to the mosque or something else. Who do I think I am? Do I have that basic understanding? And what is my character? And then the next thing, economic development, is definitely necessary. Absolutely. But again, with an understanding of whose property it is that we're using, and with an understanding that it's worked out already. Now think about it. When a child is born, right away there's milk in the mother's breast. Who made that arrangement? So there was a government board that got together and decided this would be a good thing for the people. No, it's God's arrangement. You put a seed in the ground and you add some water and some sunshine, which is already provided, and what comes out? And whose arrangement is that? My argument is that the necessary ingredients for economic prosperity are already there and we're ignoring them or abusing them. I mentioned the animals. The animal industry, the industry of slaughtering animals for food, if you look at it, look at the numbers, it's one of the most wasteful industries in the world. The amount of food that you actually get, you know, your output is tiny compared to your input. The animal eats so much grain, and you eat so much meat, and you pay. Like anything. It's the, one of the worst things you can do for your water supply, the amount of water that's used up in that industry, and all the disease. And, I mean, it's a terrible industry. And what to speak of the agony that's being caused to other living creatures. And it's not, it's totally contrary to nature's arrangement. By nature's arrangement, the cow will give you milk for free. You don't have to kill it. And the bull will give you work. You don't have to buy a tractor from America or the Soviet Union or some African country. You don't have to fill it with petrol whose price goes up and down according to the rand dollar exchange rate. You don't have to have factories with smoke coming out of them and going into your skies so that you have to have, now what are we going to do about the smoke? Bull provides traction. I mentioned this village project in Congo. They're working with oxen. The oxen, what's the input for the oxen? Food that grows from the ground, grains. And a farmer, you know, a family that could till 1 acre of land with their hands can now handle 10. And he was saying, don't get bigger than that. Don't go into, you know, thousands and thousands of acres. That's just, again, an exploitation system. 10 acres, where you were making $1,000, $2,000 a year on your 1 acre, with the help of the oxen and 10 acres, you're making $10,000 to $20,000 a year. And what does that do for the local economy? And without slaughter, without nasty factories, without punching time clocks, without living an unnatural way of life, without destroying the land, without having to buy this and that from outside, again, benefiting enormous corporations, your economic prosperity is already in the country, in the very land itself. That's the Vedic point of view.
We have time for a few more questions.
Okay.
We have to ask a question that this one we cannot answer.
It shouldn't be hard.
Hello. My name is Mitchell. I'm a student at Vetsia. I've got two questions. The first one, with these four goals that you've been talking about, are they necessarily a hierarchical system, or like where you have to achieve one before you move on, or do they all occur simultaneously?
Yeah, they should be concurrent. It's not that I just act according to religious principles and I don't make any money and I don't satisfy my needs and wants, and then I can never get to spiritual realization. They're meant to be all in sync, really.
Okay, thank you. And then secondly, you've been talking quite a lot about moving back to an agrarian society. Mm-hmm. Given that about half the world is living in an urban situation, at least, and that most of us won't, I won't say can't, but won't actually move back to the land, how do you suppose that we can live in more with more of these kind of this philosophy and way of life in a city environment?
Yeah, good question. We can simplify. The modern way of life is so much about getting more, having more, doing more, better, and but in the city even, we can simplify our life. We can eat, for example, a simpler and more humane diet. We can do without so many gadgets and so many things that we don't need. We can, the art is satisfaction. It's not that if I have three times more, I'll be three times more satisfied. But if I learn how to be satisfied with what comes of its own accord, I can have a happier life. and I can work less. No one wants to work all the time. You know, America's crazy. They're working two jobs. The wife is working, the husband's working, they're both working two jobs. And interesting statistic. 20 years ago, if the husband and wife were working, this is the United States Department of Labor, I think, husband and wife was working, it's because they were struggling to stay afloat. Today, when the husband and wife are working, it's because they need that income to support their lifestyle. Very different story, isn't it? You know, the wife is working so that she can earn money, so that she can hire someone for daycare for her child. You know, backwards. Simplify. That's the Vedic message. Simplify, simplify, and don't look for your happiness in more things, more clubs and this and that. Look within. It's there. Okay.
So we have time for one last question before we break for a light break.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I'm Loma Swazi. I'm a student from the Midrine Merit Institute and I'm a student of psychology.
Okay.
You mentioned that how the society that we live in, you know, there's a whole lot of conflict, conflict amongst other people, with other people and within ourselves, hence our lack of self-actualization and self-transcendence.
Right.
Do we, I just want to, from your perspective, I just want to understand, do we create our own conflict as society, or does somehow God put us in like this conflict situation so we can realize His true power, His divine, you know,
great question.
Grace? And one other question is...
Well, why don't you stop there, because I have a small mind, I can only handle one at a time. Yeah, is it that we've created our own conflicts by our own doings inside, or is it that conflict is already here in the world, put here by God so that we can realize it? A little bit of both. The world is set up with conflict. You know, I'm a dog, and so I'm going to chase the cat. I'm a cat, I'm going to chase the mouse. Conflict is built into this world, and there's no way that we're going to make it a world where conflict doesn't exist. It's built into the system. I want to live. And the world's set up in such a way that my body's going to fall apart and I'm going to die. There's no shortage of conflict. But we add to the conflict by ignorance, by unnecessary competition and hostility, by confusion within ourselves about what our life is for and how to be happy. And you're right, because you added a nice little point there, that it's God's arrangement also that this world is going to be miserable. So that we'll look and say, what in tarnation am I doing here? So we'll look at it and say, I'm in the wrong world. I'm spirit, I'm eternal. What am I doing in a place where everything is temporary? Is there something beyond this world? So it acts as an impetus for spiritual realization. Very good point. Thank you.
And one other question. Mm-hmm. You mentioned, I think, if you just sum it all up, if I were to sum this whole talk up, it'll be about like simple living, I think. And is life really simple?
Is life really simple? Not usually. But my spiritual master used to say that it's simple for the simple and difficult for the crooked. By purification of our consciousness, by spiritual understanding, we can make our life simpler. Simpler in the things that we do, the whole physical endeavor that we're engaged in, and simpler within. I mean, I give you an example. I spend a fair amount of time in India, and in fact, in some village settings. And there's a kid, I suppose you have this in South African villages, it's probably villages all over the world. There's a kid, and he's got a stick, and on the end of the stick, there's a nail, and on the end of the nail, he's got a wheel. And he's pushing the wheel along with the stick, and he's having a great time. And the wheel cost him nothing, the stick cost him nothing, and the nail cost him nothing. And then you've got a kid who's got, multiplayer video games and all that. Is he happier? Is his life better? So it's practical. He's satisfied with something simple. And we teach him that, no, you have to have this, and you have to have that, and you have to have this, and you have to, be able to slay all these people in real time. And so, Srila Prabhupada taught that we can actually simplify our lives by spiritual knowledge. And he offered by chanting of the names of God. That will simplify our lives. He presented that. Probably, if you've heard of Srila Prabhupada, you've heard of the Hare Krishna mantra, which is nothing more than names of God. And his message was that by chanting these names of God, we purify our consciousness, we become more easy, we become satisfied with them. So on one side you have something so easy to do that anyone without any education can do it. And on the other side you have a whole library of books for those who are looking for philosophy and analysis of so many things. Okay. Thank you so much.
So, Your Holiness, we thank you. Thank you very much for your wisdom and your provocative statements that has pierced the veil that covers what we call education. We'll now adjourn to the left-hand side or in front of us to have a light snack. Thank you very much for your attention. Very good evening.
Good evening. Good evening, everyone. My name is Kulum Zinon Dolane. I'm doing my third year in accounting, and I'm the chairperson for the Bhakti Yoga Society. On behalf of the society, we would like to thank His Holiness Jayavita Swami, Dr. Ramchandra Singh, the BBT Africa team for helping us and engaging us in this beautiful program. As a token of appreciation, we would like to present these gifts. Thank you.